This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. October 7th, 2023. It is now January 2025, and the Gaza war is unsolved as long as the hostages are unsolved. I welcome Jonathan Schanzer, Executive Director of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. We go to the news that we have that the list of 34 hostages now being discussed in Qatar, not in Cairo, in Qatar, between representatives of Hamas and the Israeli Defense Forces, and we believe other actors are sitting at the table. Those 34 names are the part of the solution, but they are said to have been originally about 100. And where are they in the negotiation? What is this? And the Times of Israel has a headline that suggests they'll never come home because it's the one strength that Hamas believes it holds. Jonathan, a very good evening to you. 100, 102, that's the list. Why 34? How does this work? What is the expectation? Where's the advantage of a partial exchange for a ceasefire? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. I think this is a non-starter. The idea that there are 100 hostages still remaining in Gaza and that only 34 would be released, and it's unclear how many alive and how many dead, that's a recipe for continued fighting. That's a recipe for more war in the Middle East. We have seen statements from Donald Trump and from his nominees for important positions as it relates to national security in the Middle East. They have all said unequivocally that they expect a full resolution to this crisis, but that is not what is on the table right now. 34 total release. And as I understand it, perhaps 22 of them, at least the last I heard, would be alive, the rest returning bodies. This is absolutely a recipe for continued fighting in Gaza. So if the idea is to somehow wrap this up, what Hamas is putting on the table, what the Qataris are endorsing, what the Egyptians are endorsing, what the Mossad is potentially willing to accept, makes very little sense to me. The only thing that I think we can say is that it might alleviate the suffering of, you know, two or three dozen hostage family members in Israel, but it certainly does not solve the wider problem of the war.
What is left of Hamas? Who's driving it? Is there a hidden hand here, Jonathan?
Well, it's interesting. You know, Mohammed Sinwar, Yahya Sinwar's brother, is purportedly the man who's still running the war on the ground in Gaza. But the war itself is not much to look at. You know, all of the brigades, the original 24 brigades of Hamas, have been picked apart. Now, some have regrouped and tried to work together, but they're dealing with fighters now that have very little training. They've joined Hamas, the vast majority of them. We understand that there could be as many as 10,000 fighters, that Hamas is actually increasing its ranks, which is something of a surprise given the beating that this terrorist organization has taken over the last 15 months. But they continue to fight. They continue to organize. But we think we just need to acknowledge here that the level of fighter that they are able to recruit right now, these are effectively young men in tracksuits picking up AK-47s. And trying to continue what the predecessors had started on October 7th. It is a losing bet, in my view, for anybody that is joining Hamas right now. They are destined for death. They're destined for injury, or they are destined for Israeli jails. That, I think, at this point goes without saying, but I do get a sense that the strategy for Hamas, whether it's Mohammed Sinwar or perhaps some of the external leaders, is just simply to continue to fight, to continue to survive, and with the hopes, perhaps, of still sparking some kind of a wider regional war against Israel. But I think when you look around the rest of the region, there's not a lot of appetite for that, except for perhaps the Houthis in Yemen and maybe a handful of different fighting factions in the West Bank.
Within these last hours, 3 Israelis killed, 8 wounded in West Bank terror shooting, IDF hunting for gunmen. Attackers opened fire on 2 cars and a bus on a major road used by settlers and Palestinians, then flee. This looks like Back to the Future, Jonathan, from the West Bank. the gangs we were talking about for more than a year before the October 7th attack. What are they? Are they Hamas? Are they Hezbollah? Are they PLO? How do I identify them?
Well, I think right now we're not sure. My guess is that it's either Hamas or Islamic Jihad. But one of the things that we're watching right now, John, is the very porous border from Jordan, where weapons and perhaps even fighters, certainly cash, they're coming in into the West Bank, and they are supporting an effort that Iran wishes to stoke. And again, you know, I think when we look around the region, you see Hamas largely defeated. You see Hezbollah significantly weakened and unwilling to fight. The Assad regime has obviously collapsed. The Iranians themselves don't wish to provoke war from within their borders, so no more ballistic missile attacks or drone attacks from Iranian airspace. So what that's done is it's left the Houthis to continue to fire at Israel, ballistic missiles we see on a somewhat regular basis right now, and then we see attacks along the lines of what we just witnessed in the West Bank. Now, obviously, these are the kinds of attacks that are sustainable for the Israelis. It does not change their strategic posture. However, I think we need to be careful here, because if the situation continues as it has in the West Bank, we could be looking at a new hot front, which is something that Israel wants to avoid at all costs. We see almost every night the Israelis have been operating in the West Bank, making arrests, taking out terrorists, taking out weapons facilities. Those things happen on a regular basis, but we need to be very careful about this uptick or potential uptick in deadly attacks against the Israelis. You don't want to see all-out conflict ensue.
Mr. Trump made a remark either during the campaign or afterwards, I can't remember the timing, saying that he wanted the hostages solved by the time he was inaugurated or there would be, and then he mentioned Hades. Is that still something that Israel believes is accurate, or was that campaign mode?
We continue to see the right things being said by Trump and his future national security advisor, Mike Waltz, and others. And I think it's important that Hamas hears this. But the question is, from the perspective of Hamas's key patrons and allies in the region, whether it's Qatar, perhaps Turkey, Egypt, Iran, do they fear a significant backlash from the Trump administration if hostages are not returned? Hamas has very little to fear from the United States. It's not as if the U.S. is going to start bombing the Gaza Strip. There's not much to bomb at this point, and the Israelis are in full control. So really, the question comes down to the patrons of Hamas. Are they listening to Trump? Are they fearful of Trump? We don't know the answer to that. And we've got about 3 weeks right now to learn whether they are going to heed the words of the incoming president and his top advisors, or whether they are going to just allow this to continue as it has been, and then essentially forcing Trump to inherit a crisis on day one of his administration. I know that Mr. Trump would like to see something along the lines of what happened between the transition of Jimmy Carter to Ronald Reagan, where you saw the release of those 444 hostages before Reagan came to office, right? That the problem was solved, the crisis had ended before Reagan took office. That's what I think Trump is trying to engineer. Whether he's able to do that or not with the people that he has in power and with the partners that he has in the Middle East remains to be seen.
To the north, to Hezbollah, my understanding of the ceasefire, 60 days, still ticking down the clock, but that it was necessary in order to demonstrate intention to extend the ceasefire, that Hezbollah had to surrender its weapons to the Lebanon armed forces south of Latani. The reports that I've read from Lebanon, that has not happened, nor has the Lebanon armed force attempted for it to be true. There is no evidence that they've confiscated or secured any weaponry whatsoever. I believe within these hours, the IDF or some authority in Jerusalem said the war will start again unless 1701 is obeyed. The Lebanese government is no help here. Is Hezbollah defying Israel, provoking it deliberately? Do they want the war to start up again?
I'm not sure that Hezbollah wants the war to start up again, but I think the dysfunction inside Lebanon, John, is just plain for all to see. There were reports early on, perhaps a few weeks ago, that there were efforts that were being undertaken by the Lebanese armed forces to secure some of the weapons or some of the facilities that Hezbollah had established in southern Lebanon. I have not seen any of those reports bearing out to be true. I think that overall, what we're looking at is a failed state in Lebanon. The idea that the LAF has the capability to challenge Hezbollah strikes me as somewhat laughable. It's just simply fantastic. You cannot imagine that a force as weak and disorganized and without any kind of political direction, any kind of political legitimacy, the idea that people are going to stick their necks out and to potentially engage in internecine conflict in Lebanon just strikes me as just not realistic. So I think it's not really a question of whether Hezbollah wants a war or whether the Lebanese armed forces are okay with a war. I think the dysfunction in Lebanon is lending itself to a situation where the Israelis are very likely going to have to remain well after that agreement expires. What that means moving forward is the big question. The Israelis received a side letter from the Biden administration authorizing them to continue to operate as they saw fit in the event that the Lebanese armed forces, the Lebanese government, was unable or unwilling. So now we're in a situation where the Israelis are likely to take the wheel. And that does not bode well for stability in the region, but it certainly bodes better than Israel just sitting back and allowing Hezbollah to rearm.
The Lebanese government, does it again fall under the boot of Hezbollah, even though Hezbollah is now a shadow of its former self?
Well, that's the big question, John. And I think it's right now it's unknowable how powerful Hezbollah is. What we know is that they still have a significant amount of financial influence. They still have the political levers that they were able to gain control of over the last decade or two. They have power. The question is, what does that power translate to? That power had always been backed by significant military capabilities. Those capabilities have been destroyed. The leadership of Hezbollah has been weakened significantly, if not utterly eviscerated. So what does that mean? And I think we don't know the answer. I think really what we're watching for is to see whether there are politicians in the Lebanese political arena that are willing to come out and to call for a different kind of order, to challenge Hezbollah's primacy. We've not seen any real indications of this. I have friends here in Washington of Lebanese origin that talk about this moment of great promise, but I have yet to see any of that bear out. This is still a moment that has promise because of how weakened Hezbollah has become. But that can really only be exploited if there are people that are willing to take the wheel and to really begin to gain control over the Lebanese system. That is not happening up until now, I think, for fear, perhaps justifiably, of internecine conflict, of civil war.
Jonathan Schanzer, Executive Director of Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. The October 7th war and its units, subunits, all continuing, and a new one to discuss when we come back. Syria, darkness visible.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.